40 degrees Fahrenheit are applied for much longer periods of time, sometimes up to 72 hours. The result is extremely tender meat with no loss of juiciness. It's particularly effective for cuts of beef chuck or short rib. 4. The ability to cook vegetables without loss of flavor. Vegetables cooked in vacuum-sealed pouches naturally soften in their own juices. In some cases, this can be overpowering. Ever try sous vide celery root? But in others, the results can be downright extraordinary. Sous vide carrots taste more like a carrot than any carrot you've ever tasted. Before I even began, though, I threw in the towel as far as categories 3 and 4 go. There's no way my beer cooler would stay warm for the requisite 24 hours. Previous testing had shown me that it loses about 1 degree per hour when it's in the 140 degrees to 150 degrees Fahrenheit range. Vegetables presented an even bigger problem. Pectin, the tough glue that keeps vegetable cells connected, doesn't begin to break down until 183 degrees Fahrenheit. Even after only 15 minutes, a beer cooler filled with water this hot will have cooled by several degrees. It just doesn't work. So for the time being, it looks like if prolonged, 2 hours plus, or relatively hot, 160 degrees Fahrenheit plus, cooking is among your requirements for a sous vide cookery, you're going to have to spring for the real deal. On the other hand, I'd easily argue that categories 1 and 2 are in fact the primary use of a sous vide machine, particularly for a home cook. A quick Google search of the types of recipes home cooks have been playing around with confirms this. Confident, I then moved on to the field tests, cooking steaks to 125 degrees Fahrenheit and chicken to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. Sound like a salmonella trap? We'll get to food safety in a minute. In both cases, the results were completely indistinguishable from each other. Here's the coolest part. It just so happens that the hot water from my tap comes out at 135 degrees Fahrenheit, the perfect temperature for cooking steak. What luck! The beer cooler is more easily transportable than a professional water circulator, and it doesn't require an electric outlet. So, last summer, I was able to start cooking a 2-pound dry-aged ribeye in my kitchen, carry the whole cooler out to my deck 2 hours later, slap the beef on a blazing hot grill for 30 seconds on each side just to mark it and brown the exterior, and then enjoy the most perfectly cooked meat that's ever come off my Weber. Anywhere you have access to hot water and a cooler, you can cook sous vide. Think of the possibilities. Hotel rooms. Backyards. Boats. Movie theaters. On food safety. Anyone who has taken a ServSafe food handling course has heard of the danger zone, the temperature range between 40 degrees and 140 degrees Fahrenheit, where bacteria supposedly multiply at accelerated rates. According to ServSafe directives, no food can stay in that zone for longer than 4 hours total. Of course, this is strictly absurd. Imagine throwing out a ripe camembert just as it is finally approaching its optimal serving temperature because it's been on the cheese board for a couple of hours. Or think of throwing out jamones iberico or prosciutto or even a good old country ham just 4 hours into its months-long curing process, all of which takes place in this so-called danger zone. Small fortunes worth of dry-aged beef would have to be chucked in the bin to comply with these draconian regulations. ServSafe rules, along with the rules set by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, are intended to absolutely eliminate the possibility of foodborne illness. They are designed to have a large margin for error, as well as to be simple to understand at the expense of accuracy. In reality, any number of factors, including salt level, sugar level, and fat level, as well as water content, can affect how rapidly food will become unfit to consume. Not only that, but temperature and time have a much more nuanced effect on food safety than we are led to believe. When we talk about fresh food, particularly meat, posing a health hazard, what we're really talking about is bacterial content and the toxins they can produce. As meat sits, bacteria present on its surface will begin to breed and multiply, eventually growing to a dangerous level. Below 38 degrees Fahrenheit or so, fridge temperature, the bacteria are lethargic, multiplying very, very slowly. Take the meat all the way down to freezing temperatures, and the water necessary for the basic life functions of a bacterium turn into ice, making it unavailable to them. That's why frozen meat can last for months, even years, if properly sealed. But when meat gets warmer, the bacteria becomes more and more active, and they will continue to do so until they've gotten so hot that they die. This kill temperature can vary from bacterium to bacterium, but in general, it's around 120 degrees Fahrenheit, with the very hardiest, Bacillus cereus, finally kicking the bucket at around 131 degrees Fahrenheit. Ah, you're thinking to yourself, so I only need to cook my meat to 131 degrees Fahrenheit for it to be safe? Well, yes and no. Just like cooking, destroying bacteria, the process of pasteurization, takes both temperature and time to accomplish. With a temperature-controlled water bath, you have the ability not only to cook chicken to lower temperatures, but, more important, to hold it there until it's completely safe to consume. What does this mean for a home cook? It means that you no longer have to put up with dry 165 degree Fahrenheit chicken. A chicken breast cooked sous vide to 140 degrees Fahrenheit and held for 25 minutes is just as safe as chicken cooked to 165 degrees Fahrenheit and incomparably moister and more tender. It glistens with moisture as you cut it. It practically oozes juices as you chew. Equally stunning results can be achieved with pork, which will submit to your fork like butter. With some foods, the final serving temperature you're after is actually below the level at which bacteria begin to be actively killed off. Rare salmon or steak is around 120 degrees Fahrenheit, for example. For foods like these, you must be very careful not to let them sit for too long. To be safe, I don't hold my medium-rare steaks or salmon in the cooler any longer than 3 hours. After that, dinner becomes a game of Russian roulette. And never, ever cook food in the cooler. Let it cool and reheat it. This is absolutely inviting illness or worse. With that somewhat dry lesson out of the way, let's move on to the actual techniques, the fun part. Cooking in your cooler. These recipes require an accurate thermometer as well as a beer cooler with at least a 2.5-gallon capacity and a tight-fitting lid. Some coolers retain heat better than others. Heat retention can be further improved by draping several towels over the cooler during cooking. Leaving it in a warm spot also helps. I leave mine in direct sunlight on a warm day or in a warm corner of the kitchen indoors. Here are the basic steps for cooking in your cooler. 1. Season the food generously on all sides with salt and pepper. Place in a single layer in gallon-sized Ziploc freezer bags along with any aromatics or rub. Squeeze out as much air from the bags as possible with your hands and close them, leaving 1 inch unsealed. 2. Heat at least 2 gallons of water to the designated temperature, using an instant read thermometer to ensure accuracy. The hot water from your tap may be hot enough without having to heat it on the stovetop. Pour the water into the cooler. 3. One at a time, slowly submerge each bag of food in the water until only the unsealed edge is exposed. Any remaining air should have been forced out of the bag as it was submerged. Seal the bag completely. 4. Close the cooler, drape it with a few towels, and set it in a warm spot for the specified cooking time, checking the temperature of the water every 30 minutes or so, and topping it up with boiling water as necessary to maintain it at within 3 or 4 degrees of the desired final temperature. With a very good cooler, this may be unnecessary. 5. Remove the food from the bags and sear in hot fat on a grill or with a blowtorch to trigger the Maillard reaction and add textural contrast to the food. Searing. As I mentioned earlier, sous vide cooking is deficient in one key aspect. It doesn't brown your meat. The browning reactions that give your meat those wonderful, crusty, roasted aromas only take place to a significant degree at temperatures well above 300 degrees Fahrenheit, a good 170 degrees hotter than normal sous vide cooking temperatures, which means that you still need to pull out the sauté pan to finish it. The key is to sear the meat as quickly as possible to prevent overcooking. Get your skillet or grill ready and ripping hot. Dry the meat thoroughly before adding it to the pan. Wet meat will cool the pan down faster than dry meat, and leave it in the pan only long enough to color. There's some debate over whether or not meat should be pre-seared before bagging and cooking it sous vide. The idea is that the flavors created by the pre-sear will penetrate the meat as it cooks in the bag, giving it a deeper, roastier flavor. I cooked a few steaks side by side to see if this was true. Visually, there's not much distinction. Flavor-wise, in a blind tasting, tasters were split across the board over which one they preferred, and when asked to identify which steak was which, they fared no better than with blind chance. Conclusion: don't bother with the pre-sear. You develop plenty of flavor with just a single post-water bath sear. And what is the best method of searing? These are three that I employ often. Pan searing. Advantages: easy and done indoors. Drippings stay in contact with meat. Disadvantages: without an ultra-powerful burner, crust can take a while to develop, leading to slightly overcooked meat underneath. Grilling. Advantages: high heat leads to fast char and good flavor development. Disadvantages: requires an outdoor grill. Steak loses moisture and flavor to drippings. Torching. Advantages: very high heat makes it easy to char. You look badass doing it. Disadvantages: charring can be uneven, resulting in some blackened bits before the rest of the steak has even browned. If you're not careful, it can also leave your steak tasting like uncombusted fuel. So, if none of these three methods is perfect on its own, why settle for just one? For steaks and chops, by combining pan searing and torching into one hybrid technique, you can avoid all the disadvantages of either one alone. I started by first searing one side of a steak in smoking hot oil and butter. The browned butter solids help kickstart browning reactions. As soon as the browning started, I flipped the steak over and immediately started cooking that top surface with a full blast of a propane torch. The layer of oil and butter clinging to its surface helped to distribute the heat of the flame evenly, leading to an excellent all-over browning and charring, and creating an unbeatable steakhouse broiler-quality crust in record time. Finally, I flipped the steak back over and torched the second side. What about the problem of the uncombusted propane leaving its telltale aroma? Turns out not to be a problem in this case. Because of the heat of the skillet and the increased convection caused by the shifting heat of the pan, the propane gets plenty of oxygen and heat, allowing it to fully combust, leaving behind nothing but sweet, succulent, charred beef. Sous vide and resting. We all know that it's important to rest your meat before serving. It gives time for the juices inside to settle and thicken slightly, preventing them from leaking out excessively when you cut into the steak. There are, as it turns out, some downsides to resting. Namely, your steak will have a more significant, crusty, snappy, sizzling crust when it's fresh off the burner than after it's rested. This more appetizing crust will subsequently lead to greater production of saliva, which in turn will lead to a juicier sensation in your mouth when you chew the steak, or so the theory goes. There is something very appealing about that sizzling crust you get just as the steak comes off the heat, and I have to restrain myself while letting it rest. Cooking a steak sous vide can help a great deal in this department. Because there is no large temperature gradient built up inside, you do not need to wait for temperatures to normalize. They're normalized to begin with. The only gradient that builds is during the brief searing stage, which only requires a few moments of resting. Still, this is enough time for some of that crackling crust to disappear. Wouldn't it be great if there was a single technique that gave us the best of both worlds? Well, fortunately for us, there is. The trick is to allow the steak to rest normally and then, just before serving, reheat its fatty pan drippings until they're smoking hot and pour them over the steak. The steak will sizzle and crisp while the interior stays perfectly well-rested and juicy. Adding some aromatics to those pan drippings is never a bad idea. And recollecting them after pouring them over the steak and serving them alongside the steak in a little heated pitcher gives you a built-in sauce right there. This method will work for any steak or chop, not just those cooked sous vide. I propose that the resters and non-resters of the world now unite over some juicy, crusty, sizzling steaks to celebrate. Fats and aromatics. A few quick tests proved that aromatics added to the sous vide bag do indeed flavor the meat as it cooks. But would adding a fat like oil or butter to the bag help as well? For this test, the aromatics consisted of 3 sprigs of thyme and a sliced garlic clove. I placed just the steak, thyme, and garlic in one bag, and I placed the same ingredients, along with 2 tablespoons butter, in a second bag. My hope was that as the butter melted, it would pick up all the fat-soluble flavor molecules from the garlic and thyme, helping to distribute their fragrance evenly over the meat and further enhancing its flavor. I also included a non-aromaticized steak as a control. The results were a shock. Tasters unanimously picked the non-butter version as the most aromatic. Some even had trouble telling the difference between the buttered version and the version with no aromatics at all. How could this be? I looked at the sous vide bags the steaks had been cooked in and had my answer. The bag with the buttered steak contained a large amount of highly aromatic melted butter. Turns out that rather than traveling into the meat, where I wanted it to go, the aroma ended up in the butter, getting thrown away along with the bag. Conclusion: aromatics are fine, but leave out the butter if you want to maximize their flavor. Cooking steak in a cooler. Cooking steak in a cooler is the absolute best, most foolproof way to ensure that you get yours to exactly the level of doneness that you like. As we've already discussed, the degree of doneness is largely a personal matter. But if you are the kind who likes your steaks rare, I strongly suggest keeping an open mind about taking your steak a shade more toward well done. At a rare 120 degrees Fahrenheit, the beef fat is still relatively solid and hasn't begun to melt into the surrounding meat, which means that for all intents and purposes, it may as well not be there. In my book, undercooking a heavily marbled ribeye or expensive Japanese-style Wagyu steak is just as much of a crime as overcooking it. In an impromptu blindfolded tasting I held at a dinner party, I found that even most self-proclaimed rare steak lovers actually preferred the texture and flavor of medium rare, 130 degrees Fahrenheit, or even medium steaks, 140 degrees Fahrenheit, when they couldn't see the color of the meat they were eating. Try it out and see what you think. One more thing. Cooking sous vide is ideal for cheaper butcher's cuts of beef. The expensive steak house cuts, New York strip, ribeye, porterhouse, T-bone, and filet, tenderloin, have historically been prized for their extreme tenderness, not particularly for their flavor. But more flavorful cuts like hanger, blade, or flat iron steak are much more difficult to cook correctly, even a tad over or undercooked, and you're left with a tough, stringy, chewy mess. Cooked properly, though, these can be every bit as tender as the more expensive cuts, and with more flavor to boot. That's why those cuts are commonly referred to as butcher or chef cuts. Chefs and butchers love them because they are cheap and, with proper preparation, delicious. With a sous vide setup, anyone can properly cook these tricky cuts. Like most fatty cuts of beef, these are at their best when cooked to medium rare or medium. Do you want to pay $7 per pound for a hanger steak that is just as tender and tastes much better than a $16 per pound strip steak? Yes, please. Cooler cooked cheeseburgers. Can a burger really benefit from sous vide cooking? You bet it can, at least when it's a fat pub-style burger. Many chefs avoid cooking burgers sous vide because the vacuum sealing process can compress meat, turning burgers dense and tough. With the water-dipping, bag-sealing method, however, this is not a problem. We are still left with one question. What's the best way to sear the burger post-cooking? Deep-frying is the method favored by Dave Arnold at the French Culinary Institute, He also adds clarified butter to the bags when cooking burgers, but I'm not such a fan of the flavor. It creates a wicked crispy crust, with the advantage that the crust forms evenly on all sides of the patty, top, bottom, and all the way around. It's also splatterless and won't smoke out your apartment the way searing can. Problem with it is that deep frying oil temperature maxes out at around 400 degrees Fahrenheit, even lower if you consider that the temperature of the oil immediately surrounding a piece of frying food is significantly lower than the rest of the pot. This brings us back to the same old problem with traditional cooking methods. By the time a decent crust has formed, a good 1/8 to 1/4 inch of meat has overcooked and turned leathery around the edges. Pan searing does not have that problem. As long as you use a heavy-bottomed pan and let it preheat until it's really, really hot, your burger will form a deep brown crust in well under 45 seconds or so, preventing that leathery skin from forming. Pan searing also produces better flavors in the crust due to the higher heat and charring. Of course, searing is a slightly messier affair. So which method wins in the end? It's all about personal preference. Deep frying produces a superior crusty texture without creating a mess in the kitchen, but pan searing offers better flavor development and better internal texture. As I don't mind cleaning the kitchen, my vote goes to pan searing. 4. Blanching, searing, braising, glazing, roasting, and the science of vegetables. For many, many years, I thought that I didn't love vegetables. I mean, some of them were okay. I dug salads, carrot sticks were cool, artichokes were fun to eat if only for the novelty, asparagus was even good when it was still green and crunchy and dipped into Kewpie mayonnaise. But for the most part, vegetables were pushed over to the choked down with a cup of water when my mom's not looking corner of the plate. I now realize that my dislike of vegetables is entirely my mother's fault. Sorry to break it to you, Ma. See, kids don't dislike broccoli. They dislike mushy broccoli. They don't dislike Brussels sprouts. They dislike Brussels sprouts that smell like farts and have the texture of old cheese. Ah, if only my mom had known how to properly roast or sear a Brussels sprout when I was a kid, I could have had a couple extra decades of fine vegetable dining. In this chapter, we'll discuss 5 basic techniques for cooking vegetables: blanching, steaming, searing, sautéing, braising, glazing, and roasting, broiling. The ins and outs of how they work, and the best times to use them. With a little luck, I'll turn every single one of you into a vegetable believer. Essential vegetable technique number 1. Blanching, steaming. Is there anything more beautiful on a plate than emerald green, perfectly tender crisp stalks of blanched asparagus? What are the tricks to achieving vegetables that both look and taste fantastic? We've all read enough books by big-name chefs to know that when you cook a green vegetable, you're supposed to use a large pot of heavily salted water. But why? And is volume the only thing that matters? What about lid on versus lid off? Does pH play a role? And do I really need to drop my green vegetables into a large bath of ice water immediately after cooking? I gathered up a few pounds of vegetables and headed into the kitchen to answer these questions. Volume and pH. I cooked a half pound of green beans in amounts of water ranging from 2 cups all the way up to a full 2 gallons, noting both the temperature of the water and the time it took to cook the beans to tenderness in each case. Some trends immediately started to surface. No matter how much water I started with, the energy needed to bring the pot back to a boil after I added the beans was the amount of energy it took to raise the 1/2 pound of green beans up to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, which meant that every single pot returns to a boil at around the same rate. On the other hand, the temperatures of the pots with very little water dropped much more precipitously when I added the beans to them. Not only did the beans cooked in less water take longer to tenderize, they also ended up cooking to a drab army green instead of the brilliant shamrock green of those cooked in a gallon of water or more. To understand why this is the case, let's take a look at the outside of a green vegetable. Like all living matter, vegetables are composed of many individual cells. With vegetables, these cells are bound in place with pectin, a glue-like carbohydrate-based molecule. Within vegetable cells, there are various pigments, enzymes, and aromatic compounds. Green vegetables, in particular, contain chloroplasts, the tiny organelles, that's a small organ, responsible for converting sunlight into energy through the use of the pigment chlorophyll, which is responsible for giving green vegetables their bright green color. Between all of the plant cells are trapped tiny pockets of gases that scatter light waves, partially obscuring your view of the vegetable's bright green pigments. As soon as you plunge it into boiling water, though, those gases escape and expand, and the unhindered view of its pigments makes the vegetables appear suddenly much greener. At the same time, an enemy from within, an enzyme called chlorophyllase, is working to destroy the vibrant green color by altering the shape of the chlorophyll. Chlorophyllase is most active at temperatures below 170 degrees Fahrenheit, and it is destroyed at around 190 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the reason why a large pot of water is necessary. With a small pot of water, the vegetables spend too much time under that 170 degree Fahrenheit cutoff, giving the chlorophyllase a head start in dulling their appearance. With large pots of boiling water that never drop below 190 degrees Fahrenheit, the chlorophyllase is rapidly destroyed before it has a chance to get to work on the chlorophyll. Even with the chlorophyllase out of commission, a boiling green vegetable will eventually begin to turn drab as heat causes irreversible changes in its structure. These changes are exacerbated by acidic conditions. Even a few teaspoons of lemon juice or vinegar in a large pot of boiling water can cause green vegetables to rapidly turn dull when cooked in it. This is the second reason why vegetables should be cooked in plenty of water. As they cook, they release their naturally acidic contents into the cooking medium, acidifying it and hastening browning. Using a large volume of water dilutes this acidity. Similarly, vegetables should be cooked with the lid off to encourage the partial evaporation of any of these acidic compounds. Ah, you're thinking to yourself, if acid is the enemy of green vegetables, why not add a pinch of baking soda to the water to keep them bright and green? And you'd be right. Baking soda does keep vegetables greener. Unfortunately, it also hastens the breakdown of their cells, causing them to turn mushy while imparting a soapy aftertaste. Seems like in this case, the pro-big potters are right. It's the only way to achieve vegetables that are simultaneously bright green and tender crisp. Shocking! Once your vegetables are cooked perfectly, the question remaining is how to prevent them from overcooking. At the restaurants I've worked in, we'd plunge them into a huge bowl of ice water and leave them there until completely chilled. But in my home kitchen, I tested the ice water method side by side with two other methods, running the drained vegetables under cool tap water and simply leaving them in a bowl at room temperature. Both the ice water vegetables and the cool running water veg came out identically, so clearly the ice is overkill. Cold water will do just fine. Surprisingly, though, it turned out that even when the vegetables are simply placed in a bowl and left on the counter, the ones around the edges lose heat to the air fast enough to prevent overcooking. It's only the vegetables in the center that end up mushy and dark green. So, as long as you spread the vegetables out in a single layer, say on a rimmed baking sheet, you don't even really need the cold water. I still use it just for the sake of convenience, but it's good to know this in a pinch. Whatever cooling method you use, it is of vital importance that you dry your vegetables in a salad spinner or with a clean kitchen towel before adding them to a salad. That is, unless you like watered-down salad. Blanching is the gateway to so much more than keeping green vegetables green, however. In common cook's parlance, blanching is the act of dropping vegetables into a large pot of boiling salted water and lightly cooking them. Most often, the vegetables are then used in another recipe, whether it's sweet peas that are lightly blanched in salted water, then tossed in a skillet with some butter, or green beans that are blanched until almost completely soft before being stirred into a creamy mushroom sauce and baked in a casserole. It's a softening step for vegetables, allowing you better control over the texture of the finished dish, rather than trying to cook all the ingredients in one step or one pot. It's also a valuable organizational and time-saving tool for dinner parties or holidays. Remember this: anytime blanching a vegetable is part of a recipe, you can always cool that vegetable, dry it carefully, and finish the rest of the recipe later. This means that a recipe for, say, a broccoli or cauliflower gratin that calls for blanching the stalks, then covering them with a cheese sauce and baking, can actually be broken down into two distinct steps that don't have to be done with one immediately following the other. Heck, you could boil your broccoli on Monday, then toss it with your cheese sauce and bake it on Thursday if you'd like. This kind of flexibility in a recipe makes planning and executing far simpler. I've included steaming in this section as well, since it essentially accomplishes the same goal as blanching. Buttered snap peas. Here is blanching at its absolute simplest. You boil your snap peas just until barely tender, then add them to a buttery sauce, or just butter and lemon juice, you have waiting in a skillet. Toss to combine over high heat, and serve. Of course, as I mentioned before, you can blanch the peas ahead of time, cool them down, and serve them whenever you'd like by preparing the sauce, adding the peas straight from the fridge, and tossing until heated through. Want to make the recipe even easier? Skip the snap peas and use regular old frozen green peas. Because freezing vegetables disrupts their cell structure in much the same way that blanching does, if you use frozen peas, there's no need to even boil them beforehand. Simply thaw them under running water, drain, and add them to the buttery sauce in the skillet. Picking peas. Peas are one of the few vegetables that are almost always better frozen than fresh. Why is that? Peas start losing flavor and sweetness the minute their pods are picked off the vine. There's a noticeable difference in the texture and flavor of a pea that's been off the vine for even as little as 6 hours or so, and one that's just picked. This means that when you see fresh peas at a supermarket, or even at most farmers' markets, they are likely to have been off the vine for several days, slowly becoming less sweet and more starchy. Frozen peas, on the other hand, are individually frozen very soon after they are picked, ensuring that their sugars and creamy texture are intact. Small, spherical peas are also the absolute ideal shape for rapid freezing and thawing, which helps them to maintain good texture throughout the process by minimizing the stress on the cells that can be caused by large ice crystal formation during slow freezes. Unless you have an extremely reputable farmer you're buying your peas from in the spring, stick to the frozen version. The ultimate steamer, the microwave. There are few kitchen tools more feared, more maligned, and more misunderstood than the microwave. It's understandable. You put your food in a box, the box shoots out some invisible rays, and all of a sudden, your food is cooked and hot. Must be magic, right? The reality is far more benign. A microwave works by sending out long waves of electromagnetic radiation that create an oscillating magnetic field inside the chamber. Because water molecules are polar, that is, they are sort of like tiny magnets with a positive end and a negative end, the oscillating magnetic field causes them to rapidly jostle up and down. It's the friction that this jostling water creates that in turn heats up your food. That's why a microwave won't affect objects that don't contain water or some other magnetic molecules. But hold on, back up. Electromagnetic radiation. Isn't that, like, all dangerous and stuff? Well, sure, certain types of it are dangerous. But EM radiation, as we'll refer to it from now on, comes in many forms. Indeed, the very light that you see coming from the sun, from a flashlight, or from the quiet glow of your iPad is a form of EM radiation. It just happens to be of a wavelength that your eyes can detect. That's right, your head has radiation detectors built right into it. Radio waves are another form of EM radiation. The X-rays a doctor shoots at your chest when you accidentally swallow a lobster whole when eating too fast are a more dangerous form of EM radiation. Even the heat from an oven or a red-hot poker is EM radiation. It's everywhere, But again, not all radiation is dangerous. Microwaves fall squarely into the non-dangerous category. At least, so long as you don't try and stick yourself behind the shielded door of the cooker. That said, the microwave has some severe limitations as a cooking tool. For one, it's nearly impossible to brown foods in it in a satisfactory way. Meat cooks fast, but comes out flaccid and anemic-looking. What it is good for is heating up liquids, reheating leftovers when you don't care too much about exterior texture, and steaming vegetables. The last is the use I put it to most. See, just as with brief blanching, the goal of steaming is to very lightly cook vegetables just until they lose their raw taste, but not until they begin to turn mushy. Since a microwave very efficiently and rapidly uses the liquid inside the vegetables themselves to heat them from the inside, you can micro-steam vegetables in a matter of minutes. All about asparagus. You may be wondering why asparagus gets its own gigantic sidebar all to itself. It's because A, I really love it, and B, among the vegetables that are always available from the supermarket, there are very few that show as drastic a difference in flavor between the imported year-round stuff and the fresh-from-the-earth spring variety. Asparagus contains a lot of sugar at the moment of harvest, but as it sits around waiting to be cooked, this sugar quite rapidly begins to form starch molecules, turning tender, sweet stalks bland and starchy. How do I pick the best asparagus at the market? Whether you choose bright green spears, mild white stalks, which are grown underground to prevent chlorophyll development, or one of the purple varieties, you should look for the same things: firm, crisp stalks with tight, fully closed budding tips. As asparagus ages, the petals on the tips will slowly open up, dry out, or fall off. Asparagus should appear moist but not wet, fresh cut, and bright, not dry or woody. Your best bet for good asparagus is at a farmer's market or direct from a farm. Unless your supermarkets are far, far better than mine, the asparagus you get in them, even during peak season, have been out of the earth for far too long to let their flavor shine. Unless it comes direct from a farmer, asparagus's point of origin is always written either on a label or rubber band affixed to the bunch. Do me, your farmer, and your taste buds a favor. If you live in New England, don't buy Peruvian asparagus in the middle of May. What about thickness? Does it make a difference in flavor? Asparagus comes in all sizes, from slim, pencil-wide stalks to big fat ones as thick as your thumb. But believe it or not, size has nothing to do with age. Asparagus grows from an underground crown, from which scores of stalks shoot forth. It takes about 3 seasons for this crown to begin producing edible stalks, and after that, it'll continue to produce stalks for at least a couple of decades. It's the age and variety of the crown that determines the thickness of a stalk. A farmer can't simply wait for a thin stalk to grow into a thicker one. That won't happen until a few seasons later. While both can be fantastic, I generally choose one size over the other depending on how I'm going to cook it. Or, more likely, I choose my cooking method based on the size of asparagus I happen to pick up at the farmer's market. Spears about 1/3 inch thick or thinner tend to be more intense in flavor and less watery. They're also a little bit tougher and snappier due to their higher ratio of fibrous skin to softer interior. This makes them ideal for blanching and serving hot or cold, stir-frying, or even just eating raw as a snack. Higher heat methods like broiling or grilling tend to dry them out a little too much, though if you like that charred asparagus flavor, you might still consider cooking them with these methods. Spears thicker than 1/3 inch are considerably more tender than thinner stalks, but they can get a little watery if you steam or boil them. High-heat cooking methods like grilling, broiling, stir-frying, and pan-searing are best, allowing you to get them nice and caramelized on their exterior while still maintaining a bit of bite. I also use large spears for braising. I've heard that I need to snap off the bottoms of the stalks, and that somehow the stalk will tell me where it's supposed to snap. Any truth in this crazy story? Depending on its age, the bottom part of a stalk of asparagus can get unpleasantly woody or fibrous, and so usually needs to be trimmed. But what's the best way to do this? Traditional wisdom does tell you that the foolproof way is to simply grasp the stalk at both ends and snap it, the asparagus magically breaking exactly where it needs to. This question is often debated, and most people come down on the side of snapping. But is it really the best method? After some pretty extensive testing, I've come to realize that it's all a bunch of hokum. Indeed, depending on exactly how you apply force to the stalk, you can get it to snap pretty much anywhere along its length, even when your hands are in the exact same position. Check this out. I snapped several stalks with my hands, holding each one of them at the exact same point, and was still able to make them break wherever I wanted them to. Quite easily, I might add. Far better is to line them up, determine where most of the stalks appear to become woody, the stalk will begin to fade to white at that point, and then slice them all at once with a knife, picking out any outliers and trimming them as necessary on a case-by-case basis. Should I peel my asparagus? Even when the stalks are properly trimmed, the outer layers can have a fibrousness that is apparently upsetting to the palates of people who do things like write Michelin guides. Use a standard Y peeler to shave the skin off, starting right below the tip. The flavorful trimmings can be added to your vegetable or chicken stock, or blanched and pureed into a soup or sauce. What's the best way to store asparagus? The best way to store asparagus is not to. As I said, its flavor dramatically diminishes over time, so the sooner you get it in the pan and into your belly, the better. If you absolutely must store asparagus, treat it like you would a bunch of flowers. Trim the ends and stand the stalks up in a cup or glass of water, loosely cover the tips with a plastic bag to prevent evaporation, and set the whole thing in the fridge. Some people recommend adding salt or sugar to the water, but I've never been able to detect any difference in flavor if you do this. Don't bother. Essential vegetable technique number 2. Searing, sautéing. Though searing and sautéing are similar in appearance and setup, both require the use of a skillet and some fat, there are some subtle differences between the two. With searing, the goal is to brown the exterior of the vegetables in order to promote the development of the complex flavors created by the Maillard reaction. These reactions take place in the realm above 350 degrees Fahrenheit or so. Cooking with very little movement helps improve this browning, as it allows energy from the skillet and the hot oil to be transferred to the same part of a piece of food for a long period of time. High heat is the order of the day here. With sautéing, the goal is to cook a whole mess of small bits of food evenly. Oftentimes, sautéing is the first step in a much longer recipe, as when you soften onions and olive oil as the first step to a biscuit gravy or pasta sauce. Other times, sautéing is the only step needed to take a food from raw to table-ready. Brussels sprouts worth eating. Brassicas, that is, cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and the like, are particularly well-suited for searing. They are rich in the sulfurous compounds known as glucosinolates, and even the slightest bit of overcooking can cause these chemicals to break down, producing the foul-smelling odor of long-cooked cabbage or sprouts. It's what I always imagined Charlie Bucket's house smelled like. The effect is less pronounced in broccoli and cauliflower, but still rather unpleasant. At the same time those sulfurous compounds are being released, more desirable, distinctively sharp, mustard-like compounds are being actively destroyed by an enzyme within the vegetable. This enzyme isn't deactivated until it reaches around 180 degrees Fahrenheit or so. In order to get the best flavor from your brassicas, your goal is to get them above this 180 degree Fahrenheit mark as quickly as possible. Searing is one of the best ways to accomplish this. Let's talk Brussels sprouts, the much maligned vegetable that happens to be my favorite. I love them any number of ways, shredded into crispy hash, roasted in a hot oven, braised with white wine, but certainly my favorite way is seared in a ripping hot skillet that not only heats them rapidly, but also chars the leaves a bit, developing the sort of rich, sweet, nutty flavors that only the best brassica-tinted dreams are made of. Want an even better suggestion? sear them in pork fat. When picking the appropriate pork product for your sprouts, anything fatty and cured will do, really. It's just a matter of personal taste. Slab bacon works well. I cut it into strips that you can call lardons, if you're fancy, or French, or both. Equally good, or maybe even better, would be guanciale, salty cured pork jowl. I've done this with dry-cured Spanish chorizo as well, which may be my favorite fat to use. No matter what, before you start cooking the sprouts, you've got to render the fat out of the bacon or pork. You could try doing that in a dry skillet, but air is a notoriously poor conductor of heat, which means that only the part of the bacon in direct contact with the pan is really heating up. Much better is to start with a little water in the skillet, just enough to cover the bacon. If you blast the heat, the water quickly evaporates, all the while heating the bacon and getting the rendering process started. By the time the water is gone, enough fat will have melted out, though I like to add a bit of vegetable or olive oil as extra insurance, that the bacon should be able to finish cooking quickly and evenly, crisping up far better than it would on its own. Once you've got your supply of rendered pork fat, it's time to cook the sprouts themselves. If you're doing an unusually large amount, you can always jack up the oven to maximum temperature, toss the sprouts with the pork fat, and roast them until charred. Oven sear them, if you will. By splitting the sprouts in half, you increase their surface area and also give them a stable surface to sit upon while searing. This helps maximize the delicious charring that gives sprouts the nuttiness and charm that makes them worth eating. After they're charred in the bacon or other pork fat, I season the sprouts with plenty of salt and pepper. I don't like to do it beforehand because I find the salt from the bacon fat penetrates the sprouts as they cook, making it hard to judge the salt level. Then toss them together with the crisp bacon. If you're feeling extra plucky, you can go for a full half-and-half bacon-to-sprout ratio. Trust me, you'll be popping them like scrum-diddly-umptious candy bars. The other great way to cook sprouts is to go the whole 9 yards and finally shred them with a knife before charring. The cooking procedure for sprouts split in half and shredded sprouts is exactly the same. Pan-roasted mushrooms. When you first add mushrooms to a hot skillet, everything seems to be going fine, but then disaster strikes. Your mushrooms start leaking copious amounts of liquid into the pan, steaming instead of sautéing. You begin to panic. Am I ruining them? Are they going to be ready for dinner? Why does this always have to happen to me? Never fear. Unlike meat, which will overcook and get tough if you let it steam in a skillet, mushrooms will stay tender no matter how long they sit there. Once the water has evaporated, they'll start sizzling again, developing both color and flavor. You can season your mushrooms with nothing but salt and pepper, but I find that a small splash of soy sauce helps bring out their savoriness. Cryoblanching and sautéing. Cryoblanching is a technique that was developed by my friends Alex Talbot and Aki Kamizawa over at the blog ideasandfood.com. They have a book of the same name. I've been following their work ever since I was a lowly line cook at Clio, the very restaurant where the couple honed their culinary chops. The technique sounds simple. Rapidly freeze vegetables, then thaw and cook. But the concept is pretty brilliant. As I mentioned earlier in the discussion on peas, freezing vegetables actually causes many of the same reactions as blanching does, namely, helping cells to break down and internal gases to escape. As the vegetables freeze, ice crystals forming within their cells will puncture cell walls, weakening their structure. After thawing, what you end up with is a vegetable that is partially softened but still has bright, fresh flavor with a bit of crunch remaining. Eat them as is, and you won't be all that happy. Their texture tends to be a little flaccid. But if you sauté them after thawing to soften them just the slightest bit more, you'll end up with vegetables with perfect color, perfect texture, and the brightest, freshest flavor you've ever had from a sautéed vegetable. The other beauty of the technique, of course, is that you can store your vegetables pretty much indefinitely in the freezer, requiring just a half hour or so to let them thaw at room temperature. Preparing vegetables for cryoblanching. Essential to good cryoblanching is rapid freezing. This means two things. First, you must use vegetables with a small cross-section, like green beans, asparagus, or peas. And second, you must freeze them rapidly in a single layer. If you've got a vacuum sealer, such as a food saver, you can arrange your vegetables in a single layer in the bag before sealing them, then toss the bag directly into the freezer. Alternatively, lay your vegetables out in a single layer on a rimmed baking sheet and place them in the freezer uncovered. Once they are completely frozen, give it a few hours to be safe, transfer them to a Ziploc freezer bag, squeeze out any excess air, seal, and return to the freezer. They should be good for at least a few months and can be cooked directly from frozen. Essential vegetable technique number 3, braising. Braising is a slow cooking process you see most often applied to tough cuts of meat. It's a process in which meat is first seared in hot oil, dry heat, then slow cooked in a pot with liquid, moist heat. The result is meat that has the flavor that comes with good browning, but becomes completely fork tender as the connective tissues slowly break down. Vegetables also take well to braising, and the technique is almost identical, with two key differences. First is temperature. In order to be fully tenderized, vegetables must be cooked to at least 183 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature at which pectin, the intracellular glue that holds them together, begins to break down. That means that while with meats it's preferable to keep the liquid at below a simmer, with vegetables you can simmer away without fear of them toughening or drying out. Second is time. Vegetables cook much faster than meats do. While a beef stew can take upward of 3 hours to tenderize the meat, most braised vegetables will be as tender as they'll ever become in 20 minutes or less. This is good news for you. For a while in the late 1990s and early 2000s, it became bafflingly fashionable to serve vegetables that were still essentially raw. Foodies and their ilk called them al dente and proclaimed that any green bean that was not perfectly emerald green with a hearty crunch and raw freshness in the center was not worth gracing their lips. I call BS on them. Indeed, I'd take a nice pot of rib-sticking green beans stewed with bacon grease until completely tender, bordering on mushy any day over their crunchy sautéed counterpart. Okay, perhaps that's going a bit too far, but in the winter, no side dish could be better. Ditto for asparagus. The recipe later is my absolute favorite way to prepare asparagus, but one that was looked down upon for many years. Why would you want to eat drab green vegetables? People would ask. Because they taste as awesome as MacGyver was cool, that's why. I sear my stalks in a bit of oil first to develop flavor, then deglaze the pan with water or stock, add a big knob of butter, put a lid on the whole thing, and let the asparagus cook in the liquid as it reduces. By the time the stalks are tender, your stock and butter will have emulsified into a slick, stalk-coating sauce that adds richness and sweet flavor to each bite. It's awesome! Essential vegetable technique number 4, glazing. This is the ultimate all-in-one pan technique for vegetables, and it works particularly well for those vegetables that don't get hurt by long cooking. Carrots, parsnips, onions, turnips, radishes. Hardy vegetables of all sorts, in fact. The traditional French technique involves cooking vegetables in a skillet with butter, chicken stock, sugar, and salt, slowly simmering them so that by the time the vegetables are cooked through, the stock has reduced and emulsified with the butter into a shiny, flavorful glaze that coats the vegetables. It's a simple technique, but it's far from foolproof, particularly in the home kitchen. In a restaurant on a high-output burner, the stock boils extremely rapidly, and this bubbling action helps it to emulsify with the butter in the pan quite easily. With lazy bubbling on a home stove, however, it's much more difficult to get a stable emulsion. On top of that, the gelatin in good chicken stock really helps stabilize the emulsion. Use a thin store-bought stock, vegetable stock, or plain water, and your emulsion becomes doubly hard to form. The solution? A bit of artificial thickening. The tiniest bit of cornstarch, 1/2 teaspoon for a full 4 to 6 servings of vegetables, is enough to easily stabilize the coating without turning it gloppy or thick. Essential vegetable technique number 5, roasting, broiling. On the surface, roasting, grilling, or broiling vegetables may not appear to be too similar to searing vegetables in a skillet, but the goal is the same: to caramelize and brown the exterior of the vegetable while leaving a bit of fresh crunch in the center. It's dead simple to do under the broiler. Take stalks of asparagus, for example. The high heat of the broiler rapidly starts caramelizing and charring the asparagus's sugars while allowing the bulk of it to remain crisp and sweet. Charred plus sweet plus crisp plus easy equals huge win for all home cooks. In order to make sure that the asparagus cooks relatively easily and doesn't dry out under the broiler, it's essential to toss the spears with a thin coating of oil before they hit the heat. Oil is not only a better heat distribution medium than the naked air, but by filling in all the microscopic nooks and crannies left behind by evaporating moisture, it also keeps vegetables from turning shriveled or leathery. You can get fancy by drizzling melted herb butter or lemon juice, or sprinkling grated cheese on broiled or grilled vegetables after cooking, but in all honesty, the best way to eat them is straight away with your fingers. The key to using the oven is to use crazy high heat to maximize caramelization while still maintaining a pleasant crispness. The best way to do this is to use a heavy-rimmed baking sheet and preheat it for at least 10 minutes or so on the bottom rack in a 500-degree Fahrenheit oven. Toss your vegetables with a bit of olive oil, salt, and pepper, and throw them onto the pan. The vegetables should sizzle and start browning as soon as they hit the pan. Alternatively, place the vegetables on a rimmed baking sheet a few inches away from the broiler element, heated to high. In just a few minutes, you're good to go. Sprinkle with some lemon or a nice sharp grating cheese. Parm works, pecorino is better, cotija is just plain cool. Post-asparagus stinky urine disorder. One last thing you may notice after your asparagus has been eaten. That haunting smell, haunting as in it comes back and surprises you long after you thought it was gone, is caused by S-methyl thioacrylate and S-methyl-3-methylthio-thiopropionate, chemicals identified in 1975 at the University of California at San Diego. It's not known exactly why some people seem unable to digest them, but it is known that the degree of post-asparagus stinky urine disorder, a term I just coined, PASUD for short, is related to your genealogy. Fewer than half of Britons, apparently, suffer from it, while almost 100% of the French do. I know which country I'd rather be in for sporting matches during asparagus season. But the real kicker is that it turns out that not only do some people not produce the odor, some people cannot smell it, which means that in these self-reported studies, it's unclear whether or not the folks who claimed that they don't have asparagus pee actually just don't know that they do have it. It's not easy to find volunteers to check for it either. Better roasted sweet potatoes. Okay, so sweet potatoes are sweet, but they're not that sweet, right? I mean, sure, you could go with maple syrup or honey and marshmallows on top, but I wouldn't wish one of those monstrous casseroles on my worst enemy, let alone my own family. Much better are really well-roasted sweet potatoes. At their best, they're creamy, flavorful, and sweet, with a slightly crisp, caramelized crust. Too often, though, roasted sweet potatoes end up mealy, starchy, and bland. How can the same vegetable produce such distinctly different results? How does one get a sweet potato to really live up to its name? Here's the deal. Starch is made from sugar. More precisely, starch is a polysaccharide, which means that it's a large molecule consisting of many smaller sugar molecules, in the case of sweet potatoes, glucose. The thing about sugar, though, is that unless it's broken down to relatively simple forms, it doesn't taste sweet to us. Your tongue simply doesn't recognize it. It helps to imagine sugar molecules as a bunch of circus midgets. Okay, little people, if you will. When they're all standing in a row, it's easy for us to identify them as midgets. But stack them up on one another and throw a trench coat over them, and they're effectively hidden. Now, sweet potatoes contain plenty of starch molecules. The goal when roasting them is to try and break down as many of the starch molecules as possible into sweet-tasting maltose, a sugar consisting of two glucose molecules. Pull off that trench coat and knock the little person stack down. We do this with the help of an enzyme naturally present in the potatoes that is active between the range of 135 degrees and 170 degrees Fahrenheit. Essentially, the longer a sweet potato spends in that zone between 135 degrees and 170 degrees Fahrenheit, the sweeter it becomes. To test this, I cooked three batches of potatoes. The first I popped directly into a 350 degree Fahrenheit oven and baked until tender. The second I par cooked in a temperature-controlled water bath at 150 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 hour before baking. The last I par cooked in the water bath overnight before baking. You can immediately see that the par cooked potatoes browned better, indicating a higher sugar content that allowed them to caramelize faster. The color difference was also reflected in the flavor. The par-cooked potatoes were significantly sweeter and more flavorful than the plain roasted potatoes, which were starchy and bland. Interestingly, the hour-long par-cooked potatoes were nearly as flavorful as the overnight potatoes, which means you've really got to cook them for only an hour at 150 degrees Fahrenheit. If you've got a temperature-controlled water bath, the path to better sweet potatoes is an obvious one. Just bag your potatoes, cook them as long as you'd like at 150 degrees Fahrenheit, any higher, and I found they softened too much before cooking, and then pop them into the oven while your turkey is resting. For the rest of you, there are a couple of options. You could always go the beer cooler sous vide route. It's cheap and effective, and it will easily hold the proper temperature for the requisite hour. Just put your potatoes in a Ziploc bag with the air squeezed out, then put them into a cooler filled with water at 150 degrees Fahrenheit, close the lid, wait an hour, and you're ready to roast. The good thing about sweet potatoes is that they're less finicky than, say, a steak, which means that you don't have to worry about getting the temperature exactly right. In fact, as long as your water's above 135 degrees and below 170 degrees Fahrenheit, it'll have a positive effect on their sweetness. Don't want to use the cooler? Here's an even easier way to do it. Bring 3 quarts of water to a boil in a large pot. Add 4 cups of room temperature water. This should bring your water down to around 175 degrees Fahrenheit. Add a few pounds of sliced or diced sweet potatoes to that water, and it'll come down to well within the requisite range. Pop a lid on the pot, put it in a warm part of your kitchen, and leave it there for a couple hours. Then simply drain the potatoes and roast at your leisure. Your mouth will thank you as well as your family. I am what I am. So, as all of you highly educated eaters probably already know, the thing that we call a yam in the United States is not a yam. A true yam is a gigantic, starchy, sticky root from a large grass-like plant native to Africa. These days, yams are mostly found in Africa, South America, and the Pacific Islands. Very rarely do they make their way here. The things we call yams are in fact a type of sweet potato, a different plant entirely. Sweet potatoes come in a few different varieties, but they can basically be broken down into two groups, which behave differently when cooked. Dry sweet potatoes, like white-fleshed American sweet potatoes or Okinawan purple potatoes, are less sweet and starchier than moist sweet potatoes. They turn fluffy when cooked, and in many recipes can be a good substitute for regular potatoes, albeit with a flavor all their own. Moist sweet potatoes, like garnet or ruby yams, are the more commonly available variety in the United States. They have a higher water content and sugar content than dry sweet potatoes, and they cook up creamy and rich rather than fluffy. They are the ones called for in most recipes. Potatoes. Despite the fact that they qualify as vegetables under certain definitions, potatoes are so vastly different from the other veggies in this chapter that they deserve a section all to themselves. There are few vegetables you find in the supermarket that are as varied as potatoes. They come in myriad shapes and sizes, but don't let all that variety fool you. When it comes to cooking qualities, potatoes can basically be broken down into 3 categories: high starch, medium starch, and low starch, also referred to as waxy. While most any potato will technically work in any recipe, the end results can be vastly different. French fries made with red potatoes are creamy and dense in the center, as opposed to the fluffy fries made from russets. Mashed potatoes made with medium starch Yukon Golds will be buttery, thick, and intense, quite unlike the light, almost aerated mash you get with russets. Waxy red potatoes will hold their shape in soups and stews even after they've been cooked to oblivion, while russets will absorb flavors and eventually fall apart. I prefer russet potatoes in nearly every application for the reason that they tend to absorb flavors better than any other variety. Also, I'm too lazy to keep more than one variety of potato around. I'll occasionally buy smaller bags of yellow fingerling or red creamer potatoes, or pick up some baskets of flavorful tiny new potatoes from the farmer's market if I feel like making something different to go with my meal. But that's just me. Other people may like to have a full range in their pantry. In my wife's native Colombia, the national dish, ajiaco, is a soup made with several different varieties of potato. The starchier spuds disintegrate, thickening the broth, while the waxier ones stay firm. You end up with an awesome textural mix. This soup alone is reason enough to make me consider expanding my potato pantry. There is a chart in the bonus PDF to help you decide which potatoes are right for a given application. This is the ultimate potato casserole. It was the middle of a Tuesday night when I awoke, the moon still high in the night sky, turned around, shook my wife awake, and said, "Audrey, Audrey, you must awake. I just had an idea, and I must peel some potatoes. Make haste." She gave me the usual, "You interrupted my favorite activity, sleeping, to ask me to do some menial kitchen work? How about this idea? You go do it yourself, then make yourself comfortable on the couch, look, before rolling back over and nodding off." Sometimes I just don't understand her. Nevertheless, I went into the kitchen and got to work on the first batch of what would end up being my favorite potato recipe in years. Here's the idea. We all love potato gratin, correct? The creamy, layered casserole of potatoes and cream with a crisp, browned top. We also love Hasselback potatoes, those cute side dishes achieved by